Okay, welcome back to 2S, the Horror Quarters podcast. Today we are welcoming back Vito and Corey. So today's episode, we're going to do something a little different. We kind of want to get the pulse of Hollywood in today's times. And movie theaters and losing money, movies themselves losing money and over budgeting, so forth. And we kind of want to talk about the success that horror movies have had and still have to this day. The other day I went and saw that Undertone, great indie horror film, low budget, 500 grand, and it was very simple. But anyways, point being, they ran the Scary Movie 6 trailer. And looking at that, I'm wondering, in your guys' opinion, does it maybe signal a broader shift in the industry towards less overtly message-driven films? Because it looks like they're going after everybody.
What I'm thinking is going on is basically Hollywood is still doing the same old playbook. Again, they're always bringing back old franchises. I think the well has run dry in certain franchises. Now they're looking for comedies, which is not a bad thing on of its own. Because you know what? It's been a long time since we've seen something that's just bone-tickling funny in the movie theaters. It's about time we get something something with balls back in there. You know? And I think with the Wayne brothers, I've been waiting for this one since 2 came out. Like, I'm so glad they finally got this franchise back. Marlon Wayans has even been talking about this, you know, how they took it away from him back in, you know, some interviews back in 2025. So it was to my pleasant surprise when I saw the trailer for this, and I just can't fucking wait. I'm actually more excited to see this movie than Avengers Doomsday, to be honest with you. And this is the first time where something outside of a Disney franchise, I'm like, yes, give me that instead, you know? And I wonder if this has something to do with the Naked Gun from last year. You know, again, another comedy that seemed to be pretty daring. It grossed $102 million on a $41 million budget. And it looked like from the trailer that I seen, it pulled no punches and went straight for the gusto. So I'm hoping that, you know, if Scary Movie 6 is a success, I'm hoping that's going to usher in a return of more comedies. And hopefully, I'm hoping with that, if there's going to be a return to comedies, we might see a return of other genres. I'm missing the dramas. I'm missing teen movies. You know, I don't even think the millennials or Gen Z have anything to the effect of their own Fast Times at Richmond High or Clerks or Singles. I don't think they have anything that speaks to them. And I'm hoping, you know, with this coming out, we might see the floodgates open for more diverse movies.
I've never seen the Scary Movies. So I've never really been drawn to them. I mean, to me, I get the appeal. It's like Airplane for
yeah,
a new generation, you know, the Airplane films.
For horror movies.
You know, well, just that spoofing, you know, Airplane did it first, but yeah, Scary Movie, and I'm not taking nothing away from Wayans. Are we looking at a shift? I don't know, because Hollywood seems to still be doing these message-driven movies. I mean, it's just been a month ago that Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Bride came out. The textbook definition of everything that's wrong with Hollywood right now.
I've been hearing that too, and it looked visually, I didn't mean to cut you off on there, but visually it looked to be something too unique, and then a lot of the reviewers are coming back, it's the same old, same old.
Well, the reviewers typically like message-driven stuff, but I think even they felt like this movie was all over the place. But, and like, I don't know her personally, I'm not taking any strikes against her, not, and I'm not trying to knock her, but, you know, I saw her in an interview, and it's like, she said, like, she made a comment about she knew she wanted to be a director when Donald Trump was in office. And I'm just like, wow, it's just like, are we doing this again? It's like, you know, it's like, you know, just talking, you know. And I don't know, it just seemed like we're still getting this. And these films don't really make money. They don't draw an audience, you know. I think we, you know, the general consensus is people are tired of being preached to. Is Scary Movie a shift in that change? I don't know, because like, we've seen a trailer for Scary Movie, but we still don't know what it's going to be yet, because yeah, The Naked Gun came out, and I was just looking out on Wikipedia, and I guess, you know, it made $102 million worldwide against like a $40-something million budget.
41 or $42 million
budget. Which is good. I don't know how much they put in marketing, but when I heard the reviews last year for the movie, the overall consensus was it wasn't that good. And I can't predict what Scary Movie's going to be.
Do you think if this does well, there might be a change coming? Because you said it yourself too. Audiences are tired of these overtly messages in their movies. We just want entertainment.
It could be.
Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah. But also, too, we haven't had any good comedies in a long time. And I know that's always a big issue. A lot of comedians said, you know, because of this overly sensitive
audience,
you know, audience that we're in, you know, nowadays, is, you know, we haven't had anything that's really raunchy and good. I mean, you know, you couldn't do something like, I'm trying to think of a movie.
Scary movies.
Blazing Saddles.
Yeah. Oh, my Lord.
Everyone knows Blazing Saddles, but I'm trying to think, but you're right. You know,
Blazing Saddles, though, is probably the benchmark because of how offensive it is and just what the subject matter alone is. Like, you can never, even in the 90s or 2000s, I don't think that subject matter could be touched. So I could see why Killer Mike used that as a temple because, again, that's would you agree that could be the pinnacle of a movie to just not give a fuck or hurt feelings, but it had a statement to say?
Yeah. I mean, it was just they were going for comedy, and it was a different time as well. Yeah, they go a little hardcore with certain words, certain slurs. You're right. But maybe that's not the best example. But once again, you know, really raunchy comedy, there was a time when you had those and they were gut busting fun and everybody was on board with it. And we understood that it was just a joke. It was humor, you know. But, you know, that was a pre social media, pre TikTok
generation.
It seems like everything's overanalyzed now. And
I agree.
Over scrutinized. And it's like, I wish I could give you more of a definitive answer, but I can't really say if this is going to mark a change. I mean, if it's a success, then yeah, you're definitely going to get, you know, more films because Hollywood, you know, is kind of a monkey see, monkey do industry. You know, when something, you know, is really successful, everybody wants to, you know,
agreed,
keep giving audience.
They milk it for as much as they can.
That, but, you know, when they see something that's a success or a certain genre, then they're going to give the audience more of that because they say, well, this is what people are responding to. This makes money. So, I don't know. I like I said, we're going on a trailer. I hope it is a good movie because you're not the only one. There's a lot of people that really miss these movies, really love these movies.
Oh, this movie goes after a lot of fucking things. I was like, yes, because I saw the red. It was with the red trailer for that.
Okay,
and it just went fucking hard. I was like, yes, because it looked like there was no fucks given.
Okay,
and I was like, it's about fucking time. And again, it's not about offending people, but sometimes films are an art form, and it should be daring. You know, you can't worry about what people are going to think because art is subjective and you're not going to make everybody happy all the time. But you know what, if done right, you can connect with a lot of people. And if I wonder if people are just so fed up and tired of just walking on ice for everything, can we just get something that just says, fuck you, fuck yeah, let's have a good time and don't take it too serious.
Well, there's room for everything. But I think, you know, what we've been seeing here in the last decade is films leaning too far in one direction and not the other. And there hasn't been a healthy balance.
Yeah.
Do you think we can ever get back to a healthy balance? You being in industry, is there a light at the end of the tunnel or are they still stuck in their ways?
Well, I work mostly on commercials. I love to work more on big films and talk to people. But the way, just as an audience member like you, can we get back to that? I mean, theater attendance is still down in the post-COVID era.
Yes, it is.
And once again, I wish I had a more definitive answer, but
it's hard to get seats in there because everyone's so used to streaming.
What I
now.
Want to say is, like, with streaming, the bottle's been open. You know, the genie's out of the bottle with that. Yeah. And I don't know if you can really put that back in because you have a lot of people now that are conditioned to streaming and are comfortable. They just want to sit home and, you know, they'd rather wait for the movie to come out a few months later and watch, especially older crowds who don't really want to, you know, deal with the noise and, you know, dealing with the hassle going to a movie theater. I still love the theatrical experience, but there is something to be said about people who talk and people who are always on their phones.
100%.
In the movie theaters. And, you know, there's people that just are done with that and they'd rather, you know, I'd just rather watch it and come from my own home and pay whatever, you know, the fee is to watch it, you know, for a couple of days streaming or something like that. So,
Which is why I, go ahead. Which is why I usually wait. Like tomorrow, I'll probably go in the morning to go see a movie. More of a chance that nobody's in there. I know, Corey, you've had problems in the theater.
Yeah.
Get your money back, people on their phone talking and shit, and it's annoying.
Yep.
You know?
I'm with you on that one too, Killer Mike. I gotta go in the morning when no one's around. I don't care. I don't give a fuck. I like being left alone so I can just see the movie and get the fuck on out.
Right.
Because it's similar to what you do at home anyway. But I want to go back to what Horcore mentioned, streaming. Now, it is true we're all used to streaming. Streaming is a convenience, especially for some of us who have like smaller kids where it's kind of hard to get out as much as possible. But with streaming, though, I feel like streaming was good at one point because it saved you on a cable bill. But the way they keep jacking up the prices, like right now I have Amazon Prime, I have Netflix. Wow. I have Disney Plus. I believe we also got Paramount. Those are four fucking streaming services, right? Amazon is with my Amazon Prime, so I don't really want to include that. But for the other ones, I'll keep my Disney Plus for my son. However, though, the price keep going up and up, and I can't see the justification anymore. And the whole point of streaming was to get away and cut the cord from cable. And now it feels like to have a streaming service, if you want to see what you want to see, you have to have at least three of them fucking things. And now you're already back to $100 or close to it. And every year they keep upping the price on that. And I'm sorry, but as of things right now, with inflation, how everything is going, there's something has to give. And the thing is, too, I don't mind paying the prices, but you better have good quality content. And you can't be having adding things and removing things. Or if that's the case, bring back cable. Bring back HBO, bring back Cinemax, bring back Showtime or the movie channel. Like, honestly, at least with cable, I wasn't stuck to just four services. I had a multitude of channels.
Well, I've always said, I've said this for years, the whole streaming war, somebody's going to lose. And to me, it seems like the winner is still Netflix because, you know, they did it first and they're still in many ways doing it better. They've been at it longer. Yeah, and I see there's a lot of streaming channels popping up here and there. And it's like, you know, people, you know, try to get my thoughts here with this because I don't really subscribe to streaming. Streaming is not really my thing. I like the theatrical experience where I buy physical media.
Same here.
But, you know, all these channels, something's going to have to give. And the thing is, you know, they all what they're doing is they all try to have their own original program, something to bring you on board. Like with Paramount, I think Paramount has a lot of the Taylor Sheridan shows. You know, Yellowstone. I think they're doing this new one, the spinoff with the Beth Dutton character and the Rip Wheeler character. So, you know, you have your own, like, you know, each streaming service has their own like, lack of a better term, proprietary programs that's only, you know, yep, to their service, and that's how they try to get you, you know, with, like with Disney.
Well, HBO did the same thing too with like the Sopranos and all that, but you weren't paying like, you didn't have to be like, I mean, you paid a premium to have HBO, but it was manageable with your regular cable bill because most people had like an HBO or Showtime or Cinemax, something in addition to where you didn't feel like you're getting gypped up. But I agree with you though, like you said, if I could fucking talk today.
Proprietary.
Thank you so much, sir. You know, it feels like if I want to see a show, I got to pay like close to $30 this year and pay $33 next year. Like every year they keep upping the price. And I think people are getting kind of tired of that as well too. And there used to be a time where if you had basic cable, you could see that at some point on one of the channels as a rerun.
True. But you come to HBO and Cinemax, they're premium channels, so you would pay a little extra. But thing with those were, in addition to what they had on their own programming, like for HBO, you know, you can only see The Sopranos on HBO, but
yeah,
you also had a variety of different movies, you know, that you could watch, you know, on HBO.
Similar to streaming right now. Like, I mean, Warner Brothers has their back catalog. Paramount has theirs. Well, Disney has theirs. So,
well, here's the thing, though. See, like, from what I understand, and if anyone's listening to this, please correct me, but, like, with some of these streaming services, like, for example, HBO Max, you're only really going to get Warner Brothers movies and stuff, you know, DC Comics and Warner Brothers stuff. If you want something from 20th Century Fox, if you want to see like a Die Hard or an Alien, you got to go to Disney Plus.
Yep.
You know, because they own Fox. Whereas like back in the day, cable, you know, Die Hard could pop up on Cinemax or HBO. You know, just they would bounce around. You know, you had a chance to see it on.
Agreed. And that's something we're missing. I think that's something that I would like to see again.
Personally, I think the old way was a better way. And someone made a point about this. You know, it wasn't more efficient or more money. You made more money that way because the old way was, you know, you had a film that got released theatrically,
yep,
and then it was allowed to breathe and play in the theaters, and then, mm-hmm, you know, it would go to secondary theaters,
yes,
and we would make more money.
We don't have those anymore either. Secondary theaters, it seems like a lot of those have gone.
Yeah, then you would go to home video.
Yep.
And what I mean by home, you know, you go to the Blockbusters, and, you know, there's a rental window where, you know, they can only be rented, and they have to make money that way.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would come to the cable channels.
Yep.
And they would make more money that way. And then they would be sold to, like, the individual broadcast stations, you know, like, you know, ABC, CBS,
yep,
you know, or Turner Broadcast, you know, they paid money to have those movies. So there was constant stream of revenue, constant flow of revenue. This is different now. It seems like, you know, it's basically, you know, you have a theatrical run, you know, you might have a home video run, then there's streaming, and that's pretty much it. I mean, there's still cable. I think, is regular HBO still around? Pretty sure it is, right?
I haven't had cable in years. I don't know. I cut the cord on that years ago, so I can't speak to that. But it does seem like with the streaming services, they pretty much paint themselves in a corner because, like you said, based on the old way of doing things, they were always getting paid to get the license to the film to broadcast it for a certain window. And then even then, the consumer can choose to buy it in addition to that. It seems a lot of those options are gone.
Okay, another thing I wanted to bring up for today's show would be that merger between Paramount and Warner Brothers. Is that going to affect the film and TV industry, you think, greatly? Or what do you think will happen?
That's a good question. My first instincts upon hearing that. So as you know, Netflix was also in a bidding war for Warner Brothers. As a physical media collector myself, I really didn't want to have Netflix to have it. I know people aren't really thrilled with the original movies. A lot of them say, like, their movies, well, they do make them, they're very much mid. And I didn't want to see Warner Brothers, DC Studios in particular, go through a period of, like, hey, we have a lot of new content, but it's nothing that's really worth watching.
Is that the consensus for Netflix films?
Yes.
Oh, really? Okay.
And then the thing with Netflix as well, too, they're against physical media, which is very frustrating. You know, as Hardcore mentioned earlier, you could watch a movie on cable, it won't interrupt your revenue, but if I like it, I can go out to a fucking video store and buy it on VHS and still add movie to it, like, because some of us just want to fucking own it and watch it whenever the fuck I want to watch it without worrying about anything else, and I'll still pay for the subscription to watch it on TV. Like, a good example is I wish I could have a physical copy of the 2021 Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. Unfortunately, you have to go to fucking Netflix to watch it.
Was it 21 or 22? I thought it was 22.
Might have been 22.
22?
Thank you for correcting me on that one. Yeah. But there's nothing worse, though. If you want to do a movie marathon, go through your physical media and then be like, oh, hold on, let me load up my fucking Netflix and watch it on there if they still have it on there. You know? And I know, looks like you got something you want to chime in on.
Looks like
that
you
want
to chime in.
Look at that. Corey's ass is itching on this one. Hardcore's like, ah. Yeah. But I will finish off with this, though. I do know there are a lot of people in industry that's against this, and I don't really know why. I need to do further research, but I know as of right now, recently there's been a thousand actors, producers, various people in industry that are like petitioning against this merger. And in particular, I guess they're not really happy with who's the guy who owns
David Ellison.
David Nelson? Helson?
Ellison.
Yeah, they're not. I guess it comes down to his politics. They're not. Yeah. It comes down to really what is sad. You know, there used to be a time where you don't have to agree with one's politics, but business keep politics out of it. But it feels like because his politics may not align with theirs, there's a petition against this. And, you know, for someone like myself, I don't give a fuck about any of that. Just give me good content. But the concern is this, and I'll use this as an example. Some of us thought it was not a bad thing that Disney bought 20th Century Fox. But the problem was, all I get now is Alien movies and Star Wars movies and Predator movies. 20th Century Fox used to put out some great films. That input is now gone, outside of a franchise. You know, like, there used to be, you know, Great Expectations with Ethan Hawke. Fucking an amazing film. I'll never get that again from Disney. You know, so going with what I'm leading with that is, people are concerned that if Paramount buys Warner Brothers, we will see a further reduction of films. It's going to be a monopoly. They said they're going to go ahead and honor to have 30 movies in theaters per year. But let's face it, it's going to be hard to manage two huge movie studios. And Disney has shown that they cannot be done as of yet.
I really don't need to own Texas 2022.
No, you didn't like it.
This guy.
Less said about that movie, the better.
All good.
But going back to like the actual merger with
I'm going to get to that. No, I was just... Yeah, I really don't need to own that movie on physical media. It's a wait-and-see game. I mean, part is politics, which I don't get involved in either. I'm not really... You know, politics is not my forte, so... You know, this whole thing, I guess, because David Ellison is friends with Trump and this doesn't set well with Hollywood. Hollywood's very anti-Trump, you know. Once again, I stay out of that stuff.
Yep.
The way, and this is someone who has who's done very, very, very little research. I've listened to a couple of YouTube channels. And I know people say take that with a grain of salt. I get it. But from what I get, I understand is this whole merger thing came down of a lesser of two evils. Either go with Netflix buying Warner Brothers or Paramount buying Warner Brothers. At least with Paramount, you know, they're committed to the theatrical experience, which is always a good thing. Personally, I was wanted Warner Brothers to stay Warner Brothers. I liked it better when it was, you know, a bunch of studios. Competition's always great.
I agree.
Great.
But you know why, though.
So, but a lot of these studios are in debt. You know, they're getting bought up by, I guess, you know, I mean, I'd say Warner Brothers is actually a bigger company, but I guess
Warner Brothers is actually doing better now. But Discovery was, when they bought it, I want to say they bought it from AT&T. Their goal was to never have a, they never wanted a long term goal. What they saw was assets, and they did. So, someone I watched years ago actually predicted this. He said they're going to buy it at a low cost, they're going to fix it up to get the stocks where they need to be, and they're going to sell it for a profit. And the sad thing is, I forgot where I saw it from. It was like a few years ago when all this happened, and this person was proven correct. And the sad thing is, Warner Brothers is incredibly strong. Yes, they do have about $30 to $50 billion in debt that needs to be handled. I'm not disagreeing with that, but damn it, Warner Brothers is in such a better place now, and it seems like how sad that they're willing just it just they cleaned up the portfolio, and now who wants to buy it now? You know what I mean? We cleaned this up for a profit. Who wants to buy it?
I don't know if they're in a better place. I'm just speculating. I think they're still a bigger studio, you know, as far as our output and stuff than Paramount. I could be wrong.
No, you're right on that.
I don't, but
their IPs alone.
But Paramount wouldn't have bought Warner Brothers if they didn't feel like it was something in their favor. No, you know, especially the money they're spending to get it. It's right now. I mean, it's still in the finalization stages. So it's just kind of a wait and see game. I mean, there's definitely going to be layoffs, from what I understand, and that's never a good thing because a lot of people, you know, who need you know who jobs. Need their jobs are going to be let go. I mean, Disney just let off 1,000 something people, and that's you know that's them together with Fox. So and part of it is like a lot of these films aren't doing like what they used to do.
Yep.
So. It's like I said, it's too early to speculate. I like to think positively and hope that it has a good impact on the theatrical experience. I hope David Ellison is going to stay true to his word and put out 30 movies a year. I think that's good for business, you know, to have multiple films in theaters and, you know, to generate revenue.
How possible is that, though? Because, I mean, given what he's actually spending to buy the company, right? And then you still have to add production, you know, money for the productions on that seems like that's more than what Disney's doing.
The fact that you got two studios combined, I mean, you know, yeah, that's as possible. Yeah, I mean, you know, nothing else. Paramount puts out 15, Warner Brothers puts out 15. So, and when you say 30 movies, I mean, look, I mean, I would kind of take that kind of loosely. I mean, maybe they put out 25. That's still good.
I agreed.
But I think that the goal is, you know, they definitely, you know, they want to, you know, start putting stuff out there, you know, having theaters, you know, get people coming back into the theaters. So once again, theatrical attendance is still low. But it's
like you said,
beyond the merger,
it's a wait and see.
Beyond the merger, though, I mean, I think other things have to be dealt with, like the theatrical window. Yep. I mean, I know, like right now, I think the average is 45 days for it goes to streaming. I still think that's too short. I like to see it go to 120 days. I mean, I think films should be in the theater for a couple months, give them time to find their audience. And maybe I'm not seeing the other side of it. Maybe that's not the reality anymore.
Do you think it's because of how much it costs to keep the movie in the theater? Do you think because of what?
Well, I mean,
because that cuts into production costs too. Because I know theaters take a certain chunk, and if the movie isn't bringing in people, the theater doesn't want to hold on to it.
True. And like if you got a bigger movie coming in, yeah, you know, you want to push that, you know, that older movie out and let the newer film, especially if it's a big tentpole film. I mean, if I've got like a random big superhero movie, it's a Batman movie coming out, and I got like an 18-plex theater, and I've got Batman in maybe 10 theaters, and I got, you know, I can get another 11 theater to put it in because there's some small movie not doing too well. Then, yeah, I get it. Push that smaller movie out and put the big one in there so people can come see that movie and bring money into the theater. So I get it. I mean, but you know, and this is me talking as a person who grew up with the old system, you know, going to films, you know, throughout the 90s and 2000s, and theaters are still open, but like I said, once again, I really don't know. They're bigger minds, bigger and better minds than me. I mean, and I shouldn't even say that. I mean, this is not my forte. I'm just a little guy on the side looking at this stuff, and I just don't want to see the theatrical experience go away. So to me, I think the Paramount Warner thing is definitely the better of the two deals versus Netflix, because
we'll never get that theatrical.
Yeah, because Netflix, I mean, like
they said 45 days themselves too, but we don't know honest they were being.
Perfect example was Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein. I looked up and saw it in the theater, and I thought it was a great movie, and like it wasn't in the theater.
It long, came and went.
I think it seemed like 3 weeks and it was gone, and.
Which is frustrating, because for some of us who wanted to try to get to it, because some of us can't jump on there on like day one, but we get like a free moment maybe on the fourth week. It's still a ticket towards that.
And that's what I'm saying. Like back in the day, you know, you'd have to worry about the movie leaving the theater, you know, relatively quickly. You know, you had time, you know, you could see it a month from now and still be in the theater. Yeah. It might be in a smaller theater, but you could still get to go see it. Now, and I understand Netflix, I mean, look, their revenue is streaming. That's, you know, so I get it. I get that's always going to be their main concern versus the theatrical experience, which to me, the Paramount with Warner Brothers is to me is the better of the two. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of negatives that goes with that as well. But once again, there's people that research this really deeply and really thoroughly that could speak on it more than I can. All I can say is let's just wait. It's a wait and see game. See what happens. Fingers crossed that it's a good thing. So
agreed. Again, all we have as, you know, for any recent example would just be, like I said earlier in the discussion, the 20th Century Fox buyout from Disney. And again, I just feel like all we got was 10-hole releases. And I think that doing those 10-hole releases kind of kills it too. Like, yeah, if you're giving me all superhero movies, I may not want to go see because they're not special no more. You know what I mean, I don't have anything in between to where I can get my appetite wet again. You know, it's and then you brought up a good point too about the streaming window. I agree, there should be some anticipation. There used to be, after it left the theater and it was gone for a little bit, when it would become available again, it would help build up anticipation. But if you go straight from theatrical to streaming, no one's really giving a shit. No one sees a sense of urgency to go see it in a movie theater because they know they're not going to have to wait. Or I think if there was at least a waiting period, like you mentioned, you know what I mean, from 120 days from theatrical release to streaming, at least they'd be like, you know, I wish I would have caught it in movie theaters. I can't wait for it to come on streaming. That kind of might build anticipation for people who might want to see it on a secondary format.
Well, okay, when we talk about these tentpole films, once again, you got to remember too, Hollywood's a very monkey see, monkey do industry.
Yeah.
For the most part, you know, until recent, comic book movies are very lucrative, and everybody wants a piece of that pie. You know, in a way, it's no different than, you know, May 25th, 1977. You know, after a certain movie came out, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, everybody jumped on sci-fi. It was a proven winner. You know, everybody, you know, they want that quick buck, and I get it, but the difference then versus now is there is always a healthy mix. I kind of equivalate the, and this is a silly theory of mine, like movies, you know, your theatrical movies are kind of equivalent to like great white sharks and sea lions. You know, like sea lions kind of represent, you know, this tentpole big budget films. That's kind of like where we're at now. You know, you know, we're getting so many of these big budget tentpole films, and you need, you know, lower budget and mid budget films to kind of keep the ecosystem balanced and check. Like a great white shark keeps that ecosystem, that apex predator keeps the balance in check. You know, and we, you know, it's kind of like it's a little bit too far in one direction.
Agreed.
So you know, we need more, you know, mid budget movies. You know,
we need something like a Miramax again.
That, but the, like, for example, it's been like 15 years. That was a really cool film. I was just talking about this not too long ago. George Clooney film called Michael Clayton. I thought it was an amazing movie. And it came out like it was around the fall time. And it was
about a medium
budget film. It probably cost, I don't know, $10 million to make Michael Clayton as a drama. And I'm like, this is great, you know?
And the fall used to be designed for a movie. They used to use certain times of the year to drop certain movies that would have room to breathe, and people would go out and see them.
Yeah.
You know, like the summer was for the tentpole movies, and maybe Christmas time, you know, some more tentpole movies. But really, like the winter and fall, it would be great to see something that wasn't a 10-hole movie that I just want to see something different. You know what I mean?
But it was a balance. It was a healthy balance.
Yes, it was.
You had a little bit of everything. I like to see it get back to that.
Let me ask you, do you think it can get back to that?
Nothing's impossible. It's going to take a lot of work.
A little risk from a movie studio willing to say, you know, I want to invest in this. And let's see what happens. Because like you said yourself, it's a monkey see, monkey do industry.
I mean,
it's going to take someone to stand up from the pack.
I mean, maybe a maverick move might be have a studio just like get rid of their streaming service. Hey, look, we're going strictly theatrical, and then we're going to go straight to cable, you know, and then kind of push home video. But I don't know if that's possible anymore.
Yeah, because we don't know what the numbers would be, what the offers would be, and all that.
I don't know. Sorry. Wish I had more to say on it, but I like I said, it's a wait and see game. It's a wait and see. We'll see where in the next 5 years, see what happens.
So, you also brought up something interesting as well too about the Disney 10-hole releases, and so going with that, you know, there was a internet rumor that Disney may be moving the date of Avengers Doomsday to not go ahead with Dune 3. As of yesterday, Disney confirmed we're holding firm on the original release date, so we'll be going head to head with Dune 3. But I, you know, with that being said, though, do you think outside of, you know, once Doomsday and Secret Wars is done, do you believe that'll be enough to rejuvenate Marvel Studios so people are now excited for Phase 7? And I'm bringing this up to for discussions because as a Marvel fan, I'm kind of good with stopping after Secret Wars. Like, it feels like, to me, I've always felt like the Marvel movies are like one giant TV show, but you have to go to the theaters to watch the episodes, right? And it feels like I wouldn't mind if Disney took a 5 to 7 year break, a la Lucasfilm, to give me some time to breathe. You know, outside of maybe, let's say, the Fantastic Four, because I enjoyed that movie, so I'd want to see at least two more movies with that cast, and maybe Black Panther 3, I would like to see Marvel go low-key for some years, you know, build up anticipation. Because I do feel like they want to jump hit on into the X-Men, but it's like, you know what? I have fatigue already because, unfortunately, since the pandemic, all I've gotten is just really superhero movies and movie theaters. I don't have dramas no more. I don't really have much comedies, which is why I'm excited for Scary Movie 6. I don't even see coming-of-age stories anymore or comedy-slash-drama films anymore. Like, this is just me as a fan, and again, I don't run the company, but in my perfect world, Marvel would take a seat for 5 to 7 years. You have Disney Plus, focus on the cartoons at least. You know what I mean? You have X-Men 97, you're coming out with Spider-Man 98. Just give me some animated shows with the characters you want to use in future movies, but give me a chance to breathe a little bit. That helps Lucasfilm. Lucasfilm already got their ass dragged with the sequels. You know what I mean? They did take a little bit of a break. Kind of wish they would have taken a little bit longer with, you know, the Mandalorian movie that's coming out. However, the most recent trailer does look promising. But again, too, I would be cool with some animated TV shows and just have them just lay low for a little bit. Help build that hunger up again, you know what I mean? Because I just feel like I don't want to say fatigued, but maybe it is fatigued.
That's Corey, that's you and I were talking about earlier about the Scream franchise, too. Right? You say, take a break. Let us want it, right? I think that's what you're alluding to, Vito, on that.
Absolutely. Like I mean, I enjoy what I watch, but it's like watching a TV show, and it feels like this would be a great time for this series to end. You know what I mean? Kind of like when Dexter. You know what I mean? When Dexter ended on, what was it, season 6 or 7? People were like, it was a good place to end, and I think with Secret Wars and Doomsday, that'd be a great place to end right now because they want to focus on the mutants afterwards. Give us 5 to 7 years of this quietness, you know what I mean? Maybe just do some animated cartoon shows in the meanwhile just to kind of just keep the name out there. But let my appetite build up again because outside, like I said, outside of Fantastic Four and Black Panther 3, I'm okay with taking a break. I want something different now. I want some dramas. I want a love story. I want a coming-of-age story. I want things that you brought up earlier. Non-10-hole releases that they used to do in the fall, in the wintertime, some other genres to keep it fresh. But if you keep telling me, you know, if you go to a amusement park and I'm constantly on a fucking roller coaster one after another, it gets boring because I'm doing the same fucking thing over and over again. Different twists and turns, and one may go a little faster than the other, but at the end of the day, you know what? I need to switch it up. I like variety.
Yeah, maybe the movies, but they've been cranking out these TV series, you know, for like the last 6-7 years, and overall they're not very good. I mean, I know everyone comes back to The Mandalorian. From what I get, the general consensus is the first season was good, but The Mandalorian got progressively bad, and by the time we got to the third season, it was, you know, when we get down and we got Jack Black and Lizzo in Star Wars.
TV shows aside, though, at least they stepped away from the movies and was just trying to keep...
But they didn't step away. I mean, if you're going to stop everything altogether. See, my uncle and I had this conversation. This was years ago, and like Bob Iger eventually brought it up, but he didn't really act on it. But Star Wars, when Disney bought Star Wars from Lucasfilm, they did to me one of the worst things in the world. They lost the greatest ally that Star Wars ever had, which is time. Time, take your time. Okay,
agreed.
Time is your greatest ally. Okay, even though let me take a step back. And what I mean by that is, between Return of the Jedi and Phantom Menace, there were 16 years.
Yep.
And almost 2 decades. And throughout that time, you know, people started to miss Star Wars. You know, they started speaking on it finally, remembering, you know, how they felt with the original trilogy. So when news of this new trilogy was coming out, people were excited again because Star Wars was gone for a very, very long time.
Yes.
And people went in droves to see The Phantom Menace.
Yep.
Okay, and then when the prequel trilogy was over, it was another decade, you know, before we had the prequel trilogy, yes. The sequel trilogy, which is not very good. It's god-awful. But once again,
I like it.
Yeah, well, we know that. We know how you roll. But I can't deny Force Awakens made money. I think it got by on borrowed credit from the previous Star Wars, the Lucas era. But once again, Star Wars was gone for a very long time. People were starting to miss it. And that excitement was there.
Yes.
But see, but then once that hit, they started doing these standalone movies. You know, we had Rogue One in between The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi. Then we had, what was the other standalone Star Wars?
Solo.
And yeah, that didn't do very well. You know, so now what they did was they put it through the Disney sausage machine. It became like another run-of-the-mill franchise. And Star Wars lost its uniqueness.
Agreed.
And they really haven't stopped. I mean, you have the movie, you know, 2019 we had Rise of Skywalker, but we had all these series that were coming out, and they just weren't very good. I mean, I couldn't even get through 5 minutes of the Book of Boba Fett. It was just that bad, man. I just like, wow, this is lame. I really have no desire to see The Mandalorian personally. I mean, and I saw the trailer, and you're a better person than I am. I saw the trailer for Mandalorian. It's like, look, they're counting on the cuteness of Grogu to get them through, and it might work. There are people that like that character. They just go crazy over Grogu, but I'm like, you need more than that. I mean, once again, I mean, they should have just stepped away and really came back. I mean, even honestly, the sequel trilogy was rushed, in my opinion.
No, it was.
Because remember, they bought the property and they purchased it from Luke, I think it was 2012.
Yes.
Go ahead. And they bought it kind of like, I think it was late or mid 2012. And, you know, all of a sudden they're like, you know, we're going to have a Star Wars movie by 2015. And I feel like, you know, you could have stepped back and took your time and really came up with a really good story. You brought in characters that till this day nobody likes.
Yes.
You know, but more so than that, you disrespected legacy characters, and that got them in a lot of trouble. They're in a bad place now with Star Wars.
But, you know, let me jump in real quick. I know you said they could have taken their time. Technically, Lucas teed everything up for them. He kind of got the cast. He had everything, but he rounded up. He had the scripts.
What cast? He didn't cast Daisy Ridley, John Boyega.
No, but he already had Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill.
No, he didn't. He had his stories for what he wanted.
He had conferences with them. They were all signed up ready to do it. Basically, he put a bow on it for Disney. And actually, he wasn't even planning on selling it. It started with a conversation with him and Bob Iger. And just how it takes a lot, right? And Bob Iger kind of threw it out there. And that's how that conversation grew into what eventually became a purchase of Lucasfilm. And George Lucas did it under the impression that they would adhere to the original scripts of 7, 8, and 9. And Disney being Disney, wanted the IP, not the history or the genius behind it. And that's why we got a really mixed bag when it came to the sequels. I like him, but I know I'm well aware of all their faults and warts. You're aware of them too and don't like him, and that would cause a divide in the franchise, which is why Disney's right now has an IP that's not worth what it used to be because of how it's been handled.
They made the purchase, and they rushed into making a sequel trilogy, and You know, each movie was, I mean, I think The Force Awakens is a god-awful movie, but you could say each movie to me is progressively worse than the first one, but they're all really bad films. But where are we going? Where are we going again? We were saying about, what was the question too?
About, you know, do you think Marvel... Doomsday and Secret Wars is released, will that revitalize Marvel?
Once again,
you as a comic book fan too, like,
I don't know. Once again, Marvel. Do I think Marvel can bounce back? Yeah, but they've done a lot of significant damage too.
Yes, they have.
They to me personally, I think they spit in the face of their core audience. In a rush to, you know, to jump on the I hate to say it, you know, the DEI bandwagon, and nothing wrong with it, but there's a way it could have been done and not alienate fans
agreed.
Like they did. I mean, this because you talked, you know, I talked about this a couple of days ago. I mean, this whole clash between Dune and Dune 3 and
Doomsday
and and Avengers Doomsday. With I'm trying to get my thoughts here together with right now we're only what is it, we're in the fourth month of April.
Yeah.
So we're still like, you know, less than 8 months away. A lot can change in 8 months.
Yeah.
Okay, far as like, you know, which one is going to, like, you know, are they going to stay on the same release date? They very well may be. I mean, didn't Barbie and Oppenheimer open up on this the same day?
I can't remember, but I know Disney came out with a statement as of yesterday. They're confirming they're holding firm on their release date, because I guess, however this rumor got started, it was big enough that they felt the need to actually address it.
Well, because one of the things is all the IMAX screens are going to Dune, as opposed to
Avengers. You and I talked about that. Remember,
and that's a big thing, because that's a considerable chunk of revenue.
Yeah.
Because IMAX tickets are higher, pricier, mm-hmm, than our standard standard 35 millimeter tickets.
Yes.
So that's a big thing.
July 21, 23, they both released at the same time. You're right.
Yeah. So you could see something like that again, where, you know, you have the Barbenheimer effect, where it becomes a big event, where, you know, which one you're going to go see that weekend. Right now, and I would say Avengers is going to be the bigger film, because here's the thing. Dune's popular, and the second movie made even more money than the first one.
Yes.
And you definitely, you know, you definitely have two stars in the movie that are appealing to the younger generation, the Gen Alphas and the Gen Zeros, which is Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya. And Jason Momoa, you know, even is very popular. But,
yeah,
you know, we're talking about the return of Robert Downey Jr. You're talking about the Avengers is a huge franchise. Every Avenger movie has made over $1 billion worldwide. Dune hasn't done that yet. So just on that alone, I would say that Avengers would be the bigger film.
True, but do you feel, though, that weekend. Disney's concerned that we already know Avengers is a juggernaut. We all know that. Dune will not outgross it, but are they concerned that Dune may take away from their profits if it's released on the same day? Which is why I think maybe that gave rise to that initial rumor. Like, we already know Dune will not produce what Avengers will, but could Dune potentially hold back the total profit?
No, I see what you're saying. So, like, say hypothetically, opening weekend, Avengers makes $85 million from Friday to Sunday. Dune makes $55 million, but if Dune had not been released that weekend, more of that money could have went to Avengers. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're looking at that. But once again, right now they're confident that, you know, they're confident where they're at. Like you said, like you and I were talking. If any movie should move, I would move Dune. Warner Brothers, I would move Dune away from the Avengers, because I still think you have a bigger fan base with the Avengers. You have a lot of people that, you got to remember too, the Marvel Cinematic Universe really defined a generation of people growing up. I mean, that was a huge 10-year gap, but 10-year space where you were getting banger after banger after banger, and it's cultivated a huge fan base. And there's a lot of people that want to see Marvel come back to its former glory, and they're hoping, waiting in the wings for this movie to deliver. And the fact that it's supposed to be wrapping up the multiverse saga. It's going to, you know, I guess, you know, close the door on a lot of other stuff we've seen in the past. X-Men, Spider-Man. It's going to be a big deal. So I'm pretty sure thinking about it. Once again, these are all speculation questions. You know, it's like it's a wait and see game. There's other people, like I said, on YouTube channels that I listen to. They've done a far more in depth analysis, and they kind of know where it's going to go. I mean, I kind of heard that the plot's not that great for Endgame, but for hardcore Marvel fans, that may not matter. Just to see the Avengers back.
I don't mean to cut you off, but on CBC, he put out the leaked plot on that one.
I've heard.
And
I didn't realize it all the way, but I kind of heard where it's going to go.
I'm actually excited now. I'm actually not as excited as I am for Scary Movie 6, but I actually kind of want to see it now. Like, I'm not going to talk about what was leaked on there, but if they pull this off and that leak is true, Marvel got their balls back, and they're going to be daring.
Well, here's the thing, though, too. I mean, okay, we know Victor Von Doom is the villain, played by Robert Downey Jr., which I think is a variation on him, because you don't have a build-up to Doom like you did with Thanos. Thanos story worked so well because we knew where it was going, and the seeds were very, very strategically and very well placed throughout the run of those movies. It seems like Doom's just popping out of nowhere.
Well, because Jonathan Major is legal troubles, unfortunately.
But once again, it's
that's what it stemmed from.
Yeah, that's part of it, I guess. But I don't know, like, I kind of agree with some of these other channels saying it seems like, in a way, it's kind of desperation. They know they messed up, and they've got to get the fan base back. I understand.
I agree with that too.
It's a big business. It's a big business, and when they were on top, they were on fire. I mean, there's nothing. I just don't know if you can ever really recapture that magic again. But I know that was
at least they're fixing it, though. To say at least, but even if it is true that it is a desperation move, I'm okay with them, a studio, just saying, you know what, we got to fix this. We got to somehow make this right. And it wouldn't be like, even in comic books, it's not the first time where we've seen a writer artist team change to fix a book or course correct.
Comic books are different from movies. It's a whole different medium. So, but getting back to your question, you know, is Disney concerned? I don't know. I mean, right now it seems like they're not, since they're sticking to their release date. Seems like they're confident that they're going to do very well. And honestly, it could be a good thing, because you got two big tentpole films. That's going to get, like, what they say, a rising tide raises all ships.
Yeah.
I mean, if you got two big tentpole films that weekend, people are in air in a movie-going mood, you know, it's going to bring a lot of people to the theaters. So it could be a win-win scenario all around.
Now, I actually like that thought. You might be right on that. Like, I know I want to go see Doom 3 when it comes out, too.
But typically, tentpole blockbuster films typically stay away from each other. Because here's the thing, too. They each want to give their film a chance to make as much money as possible, and knowing that you're not competing against another big tentpole film, you know, is typically what they do. You know, You know,
no, I know what you're saying, though.
Not competing with another tentpole film can only help your movie make more money.
Because especially in the first week, the first opening week seems to be a big deal to investors. That's what they really want to show. Is basically it comes down to numbers.
True, but now here's the thing too. Now, the whole Barbenheimer phenomenon, I'm looking at that, and I'm like, well, if they're looking at that, I don't know if I would use that as a guide, because that was a phenomenon that just happened to kind of gestate on its own. Like, mm-hmm. Almost like, you know, when you try to manufacture cool or make something a neat event, it doesn't work. It just has to happen. So once again, we're still roughly 7 months out. We don't know yet. One of them could very well move their date. I mean, by the end of the summer, you know, you might get the announcement that Warner Brothers decided to push Dune 3 to early 2027. I wouldn't have a problem with that. Dune typically comes out kind of like, you know, in the early part of
the year.
Yeah, well, I think the first one came out in November, didn't it? And then I think the second one came out in March. I forgot to release
dates. I'm going to defer to Killer Mike on that one.
But like I said, we're still way out. Like I said, it's just too early to tell which one's going to move. So to me, I would understand, and it would be a smart move to maybe move one of them, you know, so you can, you know, maximize your profits. But right now, they feel confident, you know.
Oh, we'll see.
And you got to remember too, they're still finalizing the Paramount Warner Brothers merger, and once that's finalized, you know, once again, speculation. Who knows? There's going to be a bunch of meetings. They may sit down, look at their theatrical window, and they might very well come to a conclusion. You know, David Ellison might say, "Hey, you know, let's not really go head to head with the Avengers. Let's go ahead and move our movie to another date." And here's the thing, too. They haven't dropped a trailer yet for Avengers Doomsday. I mean, it was shown at CinemaCon. And there's been
everyone's talking about it. Right? There's nothing out there.
When the trailer drops, let's see how many likes you get. I mean, if this trailer, because right now I think what Spider-Man, A Brand New Day, got crazy amount of likes. I mean, people views. Yeah. I mean, and if this surpasses Spider-Man, Brand New Day, and Warner Brothers looking at that, say we might want to move Dune. I mean, because look how many people are excited for the Avengers. You know, that's not saying that the movie will still be good. I mean, there's a chance it might be a terrible film, but. They're looking at all these factors. They're looking at the audience reaction, and if this trailer drops and it blows the doors off of YouTube, that could be a factor for Warner Brothers. You know, maybe we should move Dune.
Agreed.
You know, to another release date to give ourselves the best, you know, possible chance to make the most amount of money. So
the release of Barbie and Oppenheimer, was that were they playing chicken with each other? Like, okay, MFs, we're going to release it on the same day. What was the thought process behind those two releases on the same day? You know, in the context of their studios,
I don't know. I just think it became a thing where, like, you know, the social media crowd just made it into what it was, and everybody started getting excited for it. And the thing about it is that they're two polar opposite movies, and I think that's another reason why that was a little bit more doable, because you know you had this big, you know, biopic, 3-hour biopic about this guy who invented the atom bomb, versus, you know, a pop culture doll that's been with women for generations and generations.
Yeah.
So you really serve two different crowds. Dune and Avengers are a little bit closer because they're both, Avengers are science fiction in a way too. They're both fantasy, sci-fi, you know,
action
adventure films. So they're a little bit more in the same wheelhouse than Barbie and Oppenheimer are. Because like, even when, you know, when we watched movies back in the 90s or 80s or even the 2000s, you know, there was nothing for like, it was, Movies of two different subjects could open up on the same weekend. Sometimes they wouldn't if it was a really bigger movie. But I remember, what was it? Batman and Robin with George Clooney came open the same weekend as My Best Friend's Wedding. You had a Julia Roberts rom-com versus this big superhero movie. And they appealed to two different crowds. And actually, Julia Roberts' movie wound up pulling up ahead of Batman and Robin in the following weeks because Batman and Robin was so bad. it dropped off like after its first week. So, it's almost what they call a counter programming.
Makes perfect sense. Absolute perfect sense.
And that's what you kind of had with Barbie and Oppenheimer. You know, you had a biopic versus
you had two films that had two different crowds that wanted to go see it, and neither one of them, you know, canceled anybody out. You know, this is for you, this is for them, and it worked out. And there used to be a time where Hollywood had more movies like that, where you could have multiple releases, like you were speaking on. And they wouldn't cancel each other out. Both movies would do well. You know what I mean? No, not every movie is going to do number one.
Right.
But as long as they were profitable, it was great. And it's funny. I failed to mention this earlier. But if the Paramount Warner Brothers purchase does go through, there's only going to be four major studios left. That would be Paramount, Warner Brothers, Disney. You could say Disney's 20th Century Fox if you want to, but it's really just Disney. You're going to have Sony. And then I believe the fourth one is, Paramount, Warner Bros. Oh, Universal. The only four big players left. Now, you could say six if you want to include Amazon, MGM, and Netflix.
Lionsgate.
Do you really consider Lionsgate to be that big of a player? Or do you consider them to still be like the alternative underground player?
I would say underground. They're definitely more mid movies, but they're definitely a player out there.
Amazon has some heaters, dude. They got some sneaky heat. Wrecking Crew. With Momoa and
do you think their purchase of MGM was a good thing?
MGM's always has been having trouble, I think, even far back in maybe even the 90s. So that was a little different. I mean,
their interface doesn't match up yet with like your Netflix, your HBO Max. It does look kind of different, but if you really get in there and look, they have some heaters, man. You know, here and there, they do. Okay, so there's two things here that I saw and I wanted to pose to you guys. And one would be, has horror become an underrated contributor to movie theaters' post-pandemic survival? And you bundle that up with, why has horror or why does horror seem to perform consistently well in theaters, even during slow box office periods? You guys can jump in and I'll have my thoughts.
So here's the interesting thing about horror. In 2023, there was a report saying that horror films accounted for over 10% of total box office revenues in 2023. And the interesting fact is, I feel like, as we've been discussing this whole episode, no one ever gives credit to the horror genre outside of its fans. You know, we're always consistent. I think Mike made a good analogy of saying we're like the front line protecting the quarterback.
Correct.
And, you know, we're taking the hits. I want to jump in on that.
Well, yeah, they're like essentially the offensive linemen who you know, you don't really know their names unless you're really a football head. Yep. You get paid less than the quarterback.
Yep.
The quarterback is what puts the butts in the seats, essentially, a huge reason for that. Now, for horror movies, alluding to what Corey had said, they don't need a big budget. Now, for me, horror movies are best seen in theaters.
Absolutely.
So, that to me, that has a reason that why it puts butts in seats. I can watch, you know, a bunch of horror movies here, but I'm checking my phone, people are walking by, you know, someone's knocking on the door. But horror movies, you know, going into that dark theater and the sound is vital.
Yes.
Vital in horror movies to me. And again, to Corey's point, they don't need a lot of money unless you have like the big ones, you know, Insidious and Conjuring. Those are probably bigger set pieces. But I don't know. Horror movies have a simplicity that I enjoy and I'd rather go see in a dark theater.
You know? I agree with you. And it's funny you mentioned that. Typically, horror movies are produced between $4 to $40 million on average. Most of these films are guaranteed to turn a profit. Most of these films, because they do turn in a profit, helps with the survival of both the movie studio and theaters. Because again, correct, like you mentioned, all those points you mentioned about horror films is why people prefer to go to a movie theater to go see a horror film. You know, and that's why if you notice, even in 2025, Sinners and Weapons did great business on smaller budgets for Warner Brothers. Those were some of the two standouts, and that's not even getting to Terrifier 2 or Terrifier 3.
Those budgets had to, they were big, maybe not for horror, but they had to be.
With Sinners, I think Sinners was about $90 million.
Really?
Yeah.
Just because of star power alone, you know.
Possibly, but even I can double. Let's double have my Killer Mike double check on that. But
checking right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Accordingly. I'm pretty sure Sinners.
But even then, typically speaking, though. If Sinners did have a budget of $90 million, that would be considered more of an outlier than the norm, though. Like for instance, someone said that Terrifier 3 was made between $250,000 to $300,000, and look at the profit it made.
Yeah, since Sinners was between $90 to $100 million, and it grossed worldwide $370 million.
That's still a great that's a great profit,
but
because it made three times back its budget.
We got factored in marketing too, so it's probably another $100 million to market it, so probably $200 million, but it still made a, you know, $100 million profit.
So when someone says it was produced for X amount of money, we should always automatically assume that marketing was not a part of that production cost then.
Yeah, because marketing is a factor. I mean, because they spend a lot of money to promote a movie, because you got to make people aware it's coming out.
Like studios like Blumhouse have actually made it a model of just churning out movies at low budget, getting maximum profits for that. Like Blumhouse has really blown up these last few years and, you know, filled in that space. And even before that, Lionsgate was like, you know, a huge factor in horror films, you know. And again, it wasn't a good example to be like the Saw films. They were produced on very, you know, very small budgets, but maximum profit revenues. And that even goes back to like the 80s with the Friday 13th, the Halloweens, you know. It doesn't take a whole lot of money, but we did get a lot of people in those theater seats. And again, this helps theater chains because, again, this is an ongoing struggle since the pandemic. It, you know, the industry has not been the same with low attendance outside of big tentpole movies.
A couple things here. Okay. Going back to Mike was quoting me, like, I mean, the reason, from what I see, typically why horror movies don't typically need a really huge budget is because they're not star-driven. For the most part, Sinners is kind of an exception to the rule. And maybe even Weapons, because Weapons had Josh Brolin in it.
Yes.
Josh Brolin's pretty popular. Sinners had Michael B. Jordan in it. So those films were an exception to the rule. But for the most part, yeah, you're selling. Horror's probably one of the horror has always been sold more on the idea, the concept, than the actual person. You know, you don't need Tom Cruise to drive a horror movie if you have a really cool idea.
Agreed.
Something you've never seen before. You know, you just put it out there and people come see it. Okay. You know, I didn't see the statistic. Pardon my my tongue tied here, but
we got you.
It makes 10% of the revenue.
This is a report from like 2023. Like it was documented 2023. Like horror.
Okay, that's still pretty recent. And he still got the other 90%. Here's the thing with horror though. You're always gonna have hardcore fans, but at the end of the day, the tentpole films are the films that really drive the revenue, and that's because they're four quadrant movies. Horror is not a four quadrant movie.
Okay? Now, what do you mean by four quadrant?
Like four quadrant are films that bring in young, old men and women.
Okay,
basically. And you're not really getting that with horror. Horror is always going to be very
niche.
Yeah, because horror doesn't really appeal to everybody. There's some people that genuinely don't like horror. You know, it deals with dark subjects. It they're extremely violent. For what Terrifier did is nothing short of amazing.
Absolutely. But, Considering what it started off with, the 40,000, then 150,000.
But let's be honest. I mean, Terrifier is not going to. If you had a low budget, I mean, like, I don't know, this might not be a good comparison. I mean, John Wick was a modestly budgeted movie, and it appeals to a lot more people. I don't know if that's a good idea, because Keanu's still a draw, but action has a broader appeal than and it's a very violent movie itself, but it has a more broader appeal because you have a good guy beating up bad people, but you got this clown and he's eviscerating people in the most vile ways, and for a lot of people that's a big turnoff. But yeah, there's that hardcore crowd
that will always show up.
But my question, go back to the question, what is it exactly the so I can I want to answer a little bit better than that.
The question was, has horror become an underrated contributor to movie theaters post-pandemic survival?
Okay.
And why is it that horror seems to always perform consistently well in theaters? Meaning why they're always turning the budget.
I mean, horror has its ups and downs too.
You're talking about The Law, like in the early 90s when people weren't really checking out horror?
Yeah, I mean, horror goes through a slump. I mean, yeah, we've been seeing a resurgence in horror. What company, and it's not just Blumhouse is a great example, but you also got A24
doing. Oh, I love A24.
You got Neon Films is coming up. You know, they're putting out their films, and I also feel like it may skip a generation or so, but it seems like every couple years or so, you get that company that
reinvigorates the industry.
They get it. They found a formula to make these modestly budget horror movies, and they make a substantial amount of money in return. Yep. I mean, you were talking about Lionsgate, but I can even go further back than that with Dimension Films.
Yes.
Which was a subsidiary of Miramax.
Yep.
And they were cranking them out, you know, during the 90s, you know.
Yep.
Matter of fact, I think they had the Halloween franchise.
For a little bit, that's correct.
Yeah, they had the Halloween franchise. And even not just Dimension, but one of the biggest companies that went on to do even bigger and better things with New Line Cinema, which everyone says is the house that Freddie built.
Yep.
You know, they were doing M&M Street. I think they had Texas Chainsaw Massacre at one point as we got into the 2000s. But, you know, this is a company that also went on to do...
No, you're right. They did have... New Line had Texas Chainsaw for... it was Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw 3.
I think they had the Jessica Biel ones, too. They were partnered with Platinum Dunes, if I'm not mistaken.
No, you're correct on that as well. You're right. The remake and the remake sequel.
But this company also went on to do Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Is there, you're saying something about like horror not getting the respect? Yeah, there's something to be said about it. I think it's not like it was back then. And even back then, you had people that were really giving horror their props. I mean, I believe The Exorcist was, it had to be something like The Exorcist, though. I mean, I think it was nominated for a couple Academy Awards, I believe.
Yeah, but those are more outliers than the general. Like, outliers will always happen, but overall, though, like I said.
I mean, the slashers, I mean, yeah, the 80s were marred by the slasher films. Well, no, marred is the wrong 80s. Word. The 80s had a lot of slasher films, and but once again, I mean, they were quick and easy, and you can make them and make a decent amount of money. So, but it would take something like an Exorcist or Silence of the Lambs to because they're going yes, they're going above that. You know, chasing, you know, you're getting much more with that. And I'm not trying to knock the slasher films. I like the slasher films too, but Friday the 13th really isn't Academy Award winning material. It's just not. But no, it doesn't mean it's bad. It's just it is.
But you can have some great performances as well too. But it feels like even when you get a great performance, they're never really acknowledged by the Academy at all. Yeah, even Golden Globes. I mean, it's just.
But see. Performances, but when an actor is acknowledged for his or her performance, the overall movie is still very good too. They're part of that. They're that component. They're a component that contributes to the overall success of that movie. I mean, like personally, I don't think there's really any. I mean, we got Kevin Bacon, but he's got such a small role. I mean, to me.
He was charming, but I wouldn't call it Oscar worthy. But it was solid.
There was really not really any Oscar worthy acting in Friday the 13th.
Adrian King should have probably got nominated.
I'm not going there. I'm gonna leave that alone. Halloween. Amazing. I mean, Halloween. I think is a better example.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
You know, not just her, but I think Donald Pleasence is excellent. I mean, to me, he really is. Yeah.
He sold it.
Is the glue to that movie in many ways. But now, you know, we're in this age of, and I agree with him. There's a really cool YouTube channel called AVA Pop Culture. The guy's name's Chase. And I agree. This whole nonsense about elevated horror. Just give me a good horror movie.
Yep.
I don't really care where it comes from. You know, just give me a good, scary, fun horror movie. But look, I can't deny we live in a post Get Out era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I have noticed, you know, that a lot of these horror movies are trying to be use horror to address social issues, and that starts to get a little long in tooth. Especially in light of films like Get Out, because I've noticed, and I gotta be careful to say this because some people get really offended. I'm not trying to offend anybody, but I know
fuck them, offend them. No, say it, say it.
You know, people
be like hardcore, damn it, like you're on the conventions. Don't back down.
People like
get in their asses like you get in everybody else's asses. Your ground, my friend.
People like what they like, but you know, I look at Get Out and it's more of a thriller to me than a horror movie. But, you know, it was addressing issues of racism. And after Get Out came out, all of a sudden it seems like any horror movie with a predominantly message. Black cast. Or I guess a non-white cast, you know, they have to have horror as like in the background, like they have to like kind of dress. I mean, not horror, take it back, racism. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. A couple movies you want to do that, but that doesn't have to be the case with every single movie. And like, I feel like in the wake of Get Out, you know, we had the legacy sequel to Candyman by Nia DaCosta, which I thought was a terrible movie. I'm sorry, I didn't like it. It wasn't scary, and it was so didactic. I mean, it was, you know, I just like, really, we're doing this. Then there was the one that Janelle Monáe did, Antebellum, and she's on a plantation. I was like, I think one Kiki Palmer did. That may have been leaning more towards action. I think she was on a plantation or something. I think that may have been more of an action movie. But then there was the one that Regina Hall did, where she was the first Black headmistress at an all-white school or something like that.
It's called like Master.
Was it? Yeah, and it's just like effect. and you can see that like these are all in the wake of Get Out.
Yeah,
and look, there's nothing wrong with that, but I feel like, you know, Black filmmakers, we don't have to just be limited to that. We can just make a fun horror movie, you know, and keep it pushing. You know, and I'm not trying to tell people what to make either, or
no, but I'm not as a fan though, you bring up valid points.
You know, I'm not throwing any disrespect to them either. You know, it's their choice to make what they want to make.
There's nothing wrong with saying you just want more.
I've noticed this trend, with you know. Then we had what was it? Oh man, there was the comedy, The Blackening, which I thought was just, I saw the trailer like, come on. I felt like the Wayans did this like 15 years ago. It's, you know. Yeah, cool. And there was something else that just came out. I'm missing something. Something else that I was just like, no, not that. I feel like there was another horror movie that was trying to beat you over the head, you know, with social messaging.
What was it? After The Blackening?
Yeah. I'm trying to, something else that I want to say came out, but
must not have been very good because hardcore can't remember it.
Well, then you had that TV show. There was Lovecraft County. Then there was another one with I think she's gorgeous too. Deborah Iorindi. She was in Luke Cage. She played Candace, the girl who worked at the club with Cottonmouth, and she got killed off, I think, second season. She was doing it was on a streaming service. It was like, I think, an anthology. It was a like Black Heart, and it kept racism as like one of the key elements, you know. And I just like, you know, it's just like it just gets very monotonous. You know, we can do different things, and even Sinners. I like Sinners. I was watching the other day, and I think it is a really darn good movie. There's that element that there too, but I think there's so much more also to Sinners. In all fairness, especially the music aspect. I'm not a hardcore music fan like other people, but I understand how he treats music almost like a mythical element, like a magical element that, you know, transcends, you know, time, space, generations, and I got that with Sinners. And then where am I going with this?
No, go ahead.
You seem like, you know,
you're talking about the trends of horror.
This era of like, you know, elevated horror, and horror, I guess, is getting more respectability, but.
Which is a good thing, because you know what? The more respectability it gets, we can get bigger budgets. You know what I mean? Chances on bigger budgets to where you can get a star instead of cast.
We shouldn't focus on budgets more. We shouldn't focus on bigger budgets as opposed to the necessary budget.
That's a good point. I like how you put that.
What do you need to get the job done? And really, you don't need a lot for a lot of horror movies, you know, besides paying the person for the makeup effects or whatever. No, there's nothing. I mean, a simplistic story, and if you can get it done under budget and a really simplistic but strong story, that's amazing. I mean, you know, Blair Witch, simplistic story, shot in the woods, you know, got the job done. You know, to me, Halloween, which I always say is the Blair Witch Project before the Blair Witch Project, he filmed on a budget $320,000,
and recycled every fucking leaf that hit the ground.
Yeah, and what Vito means by that is when they were filming Halloween. Because they shot in Pasadena
in the summertime.
They had to make it seem like it was fall, so they had these leaves they put on the ground. Then when they were done shooting at one scene, they would bag all the leaves up and then move to the next scene and put the leaves on the ground. But it's just, you know, whatever you need to get the job done. And horror typically has always worked in a very small budget because overall it's always been a very lucrative genre if you know how to. Hit it right. You know, yeah, your loss isn't as big because, you know, you're not spending a lot of money on big budget effects. You're not paying big name stars to sell this movie. Even the costumes, you don't have a big costume. With superhero movies, you know, typically, you know, you got a Batman or Spider-Man, you know, just a costume alone, you've probably got like 20 different costumes for the actor to wear for different scenes. Some costumes are just there for standing, mm-hmm. you know, while he or she's talking. Others are more flexible to make action scenes, and some are designed for the stuntmen, you know, to have to step in for like
Ben Affleck. So a lot of money goes into these costumes.
Yeah. And what I'm saying is that these are things that cost more money, and you don't need that for horror movies.
Yeah, Weapons doesn't need Julia Garner or Brolin. Shout out to them both, but probably don't need them.
Still be effective. Yeah, you could have got no-name actors and still, you know. And that's another example of a film that was kind of a bit message-driven. I guess it was kind of a trying to say something about, you know, school violence and gun violence. You know, I enjoyed it, you know, but it definitely had a bit of a message. But even horror films get into that where it's like, okay, let's pump the brakes. Because I think you said something earlier, I think before we were talking about our horror movies getting too message driven too, or something like that. It's something you brought up, but they go in that territory too sometimes, and I gotta
just keep it simple. Give me a great story, great scares, moving.
Well, it's nothing wrong with using horror to address a social issue, but
they've done that before.
Romero has done that quite a bit. Nothing new, but in this era, you know, like, everything's so on the head, and everything so.
I agree with you on that.
Everyone wants to be a social justice warrior. Now you see it coming a mile away, and it's like, well, I don't really want to deal with that. Like, a horror movie, I know a lot of people like this film, and it's come back to Weapons. Zach Krieger was Barbarian. I didn't like Barbarian.
Okay, I like it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I thought it was definitely trying to say something about toxic masculinity. I'm like, oh, here we go with that again.
that's fair. I've turned off shows and movies. I'll say it out loud, like when I'm watching, don't do it again. Don't do it again. And I've called you, Corey, on a couple of them. Turn it right off. Won't even get back to it. Stuff that I've looked forward to watching, I don't want to be hit over the head with this shit. Give me a good story. Make me scared.
Yep.
Shout out to The Ritual, which I watched last night. Real quick, side note, Netflix original from 2017. Four dudes going hiking, kind of reminiscent of The Descent. The simplicity of it was great. Just some scary shit out in the woods.
Well, that's all people really want. You know, the whole point of these horror films is escapism. Sure. Like I'm looking to escape my reality. My reality has enough stress as it is with what's going on in society right now without going down that rabbit hole.
Great point.
But if I don't have that escapism and you're constantly hitting me over the head, then why the fuck did I give you my money? I just want to get away for about an hour or two and then I go back into the real world. If I can't even be allowed that, I'm not going to give you my money.
Horror is always going to have fans, you know. And
oh, yeah. We know that.
And honestly, it really is a great time for horror movies overall because not just in the movie theaters, but, you know, the horror conventions. Horror really helps drive the physical media market right now, especially the boutique markets. I mean, I just recently purchased a beautiful 4K box set of Reanimator, and it's an amazing box set.
Sponsors, if you're listening.
Even there's stuff today that we didn't have when we were younger. I mean, just look around you, all these, you know, these Jason statues, these Michael Myers figures, man. When these movies first came out, there wasn't that type of merchandising.
Nope.
You know, I think I know where it really started to pick up. I kind of thank Todd McFarlane with that, with the movie Maniacs. I think from that point, it really started to blow up. With those figures he made of a movie.
Late 90s, Monster Care. Right?
Yeah, but I mean, the 80s, man, I mean, beyond the movie, maybe a t-shirt here and there. I mean, you didn't have much merchandise. I mean, the first horror franchise, I mean, modern horror, I mean, I say in the 80s, you know,
was Nightmare.
To capitalize on a merchandising craze, was Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, there were Freddy toys. Yeah, Freddy.
Spawn's rubber thing that I don't know why he had a rubber thing. Shout out to Spawn and your rubber thing.
Shout out Ewok Village.
But at the same time, though, yeah, 10% is definitely nothing to sneeze at. But at the same time, horror movies aren't four quadrant in the way that, you know, an Avengers movie is. You know, you make an Avengers movie, you're going to get, you know, young, old. I mean, you got mom and dad bringing the kids to see the Avengers. You're not going to have mom and dad bringing the kids to see Art the Clown. Hell, you won't even get mom and dad to see Art the Clown. So it's like, you know, horror's great, but there's still a limitation it has, you know, as far as what it can do.
And let me take it from here. And Hardcore brought up a good point. In the research that I've done, horror alone will not save movie theaters. All it is doing is stopping it from going into a deeper hole than it would have went if it wasn't there, which is a good and a bad thing. Like, I mean, it sucks it's not doing enough to save it, but at least we're like putting the brakes on, like, hey, we're not completely off the cliff yet, but it needs help.
Good movies are going to save the movie theater. Just overall good movies. And also, too, you got to remember, a lot of films today just
aren't good.
Yeah, aren't good. You know, people, you know, aren't liking where the story's going. So, you know, there's that to contend with.
Do you think it's because of the studios putting, wanting what they want from the writers, or just the writers aren't what they used to be anymore?
I think you still got good writers out there. You know, it's films are hit and miss. I mean, you got some that are going to work, some aren't going to work.
Oh, always. It seems like a lot of them, though. Like, you guys were talking about message driven. Do you think?
Well, I was about to get to that. Okay. I do think that, yeah, we do need to scale back on this agenda driven. You know, pushing messages, and, you know, I mean, look, I don't care where your political affiliation lies, but, you know, it's obvious you can see a film that's kind of anti-Trump. I mean, I don't remember any anti-Obama movies, and I'm not defending either one. I'm just saying, like, it's
pushing,
like,
an agenda.
Just, like, stay in the middle of the road and just entertain people. Don't push away your audience. Respect your audience. There's a lot of that going around, too. And other YouTube channels have covered this ad infinitum. You know, don't disrespect your audience, you know.
Right.
Don't forget who your demographic is, who pays the bills.
You just shut up, you know, like, you just shut up, because you're going to lose probably half of your audience just because they don't like what you said.
Yeah. And if your audience doesn't like something, then kind of listen to what you're saying. You don't have to let them guide your creative decision. Right. But at the same time, if you can't take the heat, don't go in the kitchen. Right. I mean, you know, like, a lot of people, and I see this across the board, whether it's people writing comic books, you're filming movies. Everybody, maybe it's human nature. Everybody wants to be there for the accolades, but nobody wants to be there for the criticisms. You know,
agreed,
all of a sudden when someone doesn't like your product, everybody wants to fire back. You're toxic. You're sexist, racist.
Yeah,
you're this and this. No. It's just I didn't like this. You know, this.
And there used to be a time for that. There used to be a time where people were like, no, I really, you know, Quentin Tarantino is really good at that. Even when he would get pushback in certain films, no, I really like this, and he would back it up.
Yeah.
Cool. Like, I don't have to agree with whatever, but I'm glad to get your input and get your perspective, and I can respect it a lot more. And you're absolutely right. You want the accolades, but you don't want to take the heat. Quit being pussy and just say, you know what? This is where I stand on it. You didn't like it? Well, it happens. You know what I mean? Not every hit's going to be a home run.
Well, what I notice is funny is like when a movie or whatever is a success, everybody's
cheering
up there, up in the spotlight. Yeah, you know, I did such and such, and yeah, you know, and you know, everyone wants to take the credit, but when something's bad and people don't like it,
people walk away from it.
Like, well, there's a lot of finger pointing. Well, there was probably a problem in the writing process, or you know, we probably
could. A lot of blame game.
Yeah, blame game. It's like, you know, I see very few directors that man up and say, yeah, you know, I probably could have did that better, or you know, and then I get to if you still believe in the work and you stand by it, but
which I'm good with too. Like if you say, you know, I really believe in this, and that's. Some of the greatest things I would read from the creators out there is like, you know, I actually really like this. Now, I know no one likes this, but this is actually my favorite piece. To me, it makes me go back and want to check it out again, because that says, you know what? You nailed it. Something about this works for you. Let me go back and check it out again.
Well, the thing is, it's fan passion. Mm-hmm. And you know, problem is everybody... You can't have it both ways as a creator. Like you need
that. Thank you.
You need that.
Thank you.
You need that fan passion. The fan passion is what makes the money. The fan passion is what buys all this stuff here. Okay. When fans are passionate about a movie, a TV series, a book, a comic book, a graphic novel, you know, they want to take that excitement and love for it beyond, you know, the pages or the screen. You know, they'll buy a Jason Voorhees statue because they love Friday the 13th. Okay. That's fan passion. That generates revenue, okay? But there's also the flip side of that. You got to be ready for that too. You know, fan passion also means that they're going to be critical if you do something that strays off the, you know, the reservation. You know, something that's not in alignment with the previous films or books were.
Okay? Or they haven't got over certain actors that, you know, play certain roles. Like,
you know, actors a little bit different. I also feel like sometimes fans have to kind of like, temper that a little bit. Like, I mean,
but it still falls in the same line. Just that fan passion. Right.
You're right. I agree. Fan passion.
You brought up earlier off camera about, you know, Christopher Reeves and how people can't, you know, I love Christopher Reeves, but you also brought up a good point. It's hard for people to get past him to give any other new actor to fill in the role of Superman proper credit and due.
Well, I just wish people, you know, and I'm not saying there aren't people that don't do this, but when you have a character, a pop culture character that's huge, that's been around for decades, or even something recent like Black Panther, where you know they come out the gate and it's, you know, blown up and it's gotten really popular. That character becomes bigger than one actor, and you know, however we get there, eventually someone else is going to come in and play that character.
Agreed.
You don't have to like everybody that comes after that, but I think a person should be open, you know, to like, hey, you know, let's see what this guy brings to this
character. Like how they did with James Bond, you know, Roger Moore,
perfect example.
James Connery, you know, Sean Connery.
Bond's a perfect example. I was gonna say like the Joker. Joker's bigger than Heath Ledger.
Yeah,
I still think far as live action performances, no one surpassed Heath Ledger far as live action.
And that's fair. And that's fair.
That's not to say that somebody else may not come down the road 10, 5 years from now and play him. I might like that version better. I'm open to see that. Joaquin Phoenix got an Academy Award, and there's something to be said about that, but I still prefer the Ledger take on Joker over his or Jared Leto's
version. And that's totally fair.
They have their fans as well.
And that's fair, because at least you're saying, you know what, I may like this, but it's cool for you to like that, because you know what, we're all winning, because at least we're still getting this.
Joker is such an iconic character that, you know, there's always going to be another actor that's going to come in and put his or her spin.
Oh yeah.
On, you know, well, no, well, his spin on Joker, but when, like I said, when you get these popular characters, they're bigger than any one actor. And
so, I agree with you 100%.
Because, you know, Superman is going to be around long after we're gone. you know, 100 years from now, I would like to think Superman's still going to be around in some form or another. There's going to be a whole new generation that's going to see this character, and I like that version. You know, they're not going to know anything about Christopher Reeve or George Reeves or Kirk Allen. And I'm not trying to get into a Superman conversation. You know, we had that, but just overall, you're right. Come back to fan passion. Sometimes, you know, we have to temper it a little bit and say, you know, hey, you know, let's see what this person brings to this character. You know, and if you don't like it, you don't like it. I get it. You know, but at least kind of come in with an open slate. I mean, God, I hate to go back to Superman. I'm sorry. He's one of my favorite characters, and I was really hoping this new movie was going to do it for me, but it didn't. I mean, and it's nothing against David Cornswift, but I just like Henry Cavill's take on the character better.
This is where we're going to take a moment to remind Hardcore that we are still planning our finishing our review, but anyway, we'll spawn out on special assignment.
We can keep moving on. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to deviate, of course. But
we're going to keep up. We're going to edit that part out, but keep that. I'll keep that when we come back together on that one.
But getting back to horror, yeah, horror has always been around, and horror has its ups and downs like any other genre. Like, yeah, it's definitely we're in a really interesting time right now because we're getting so many different things in horror. We still got our slashers like Terrifier, but we're also getting some really cool stuff. Like, for me, one of the coolest horror movies I've seen in the last 15 years was The Witch by Robert Eggers. I still think it's his best movie. I've only ever seen out The Northman. I own The Lighthouse. I haven't watched it yet, but I really like The Witch. I just thought,
did he do Nosferatu?
Yeah. So I did see Nosferatu, and I still think The Witch is a better movie than Nosferatu. I like the fact it was a period piece and it's set in that time that you know, during the era of the English settlers, where people, you know, or the Pilgrim era, the Pilgrim, where, you know, people very God fearing, and this family that was kind of ousted by a very religious town. And I thought the setting was great, man, and what they were going through. And then they were speaking that old English language. I didn't quite understand everything they were saying, but I got the gist of it. I was just like, man, this is definitely the textbook example of elevated horror, if you want to use that word. But I just thought it was a cool movie, just the craftsmanship he put into it, and just such a good movie, man. The Witch is such a good film. And I like the fact that we're getting stuff, you know, at the same time. Another film that came out a little bit before The Witch was It Follows.
Yeah.
Great horror movie. Simple concept, but just, and no big stars. I mean, because Micah Monroe was just coming up, I think, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of like the new Scream Queen in many ways. She's been in quite a few horror movies.
All right.
But I thought she was great in it, and it was no big name stars in that movie. And It Follows is still one of the best modern horror movies of the 21st century. Love it. You know?
All right, then, Hardcore. Well, we appreciate you coming on through. We appreciate you guys out there in YouTube land watching us. Shout out to our host, Killer Mike. Spawn, wherever you are. Come back for special assignments soon.
Okay, until next time, we appreciate you all, and we'll see you then.
Okay, bye.
Deuces.